So you've had a chance to look at the web midterm and the answers. Are there any of the answers that you don't understand and want an explanation of?
Can we go over both one and number two?
Sure. They sort of go together anyway. Let's see. I think I have it here. Here it is. Let's take a look. The diagram is probably the easiest way of doing it. Is it showing? Yeah. That on one, the first question is whether to search. If you don't search, you then have to decide whether to settle or go to trial. If you don't search and settle, that costs you $250,000. If you don't search and go to trial, you spend $100,000 for the trial, and then either you win or you lose. The chance of losing is 2%, because we were told that there was a 20% chance of the evidence existing, and if the evidence existed, a 10% chance that you would lose the case. If the evidence doesn't exist, you're going to win the case. So a 10% chance of a 20% chance is a 2% chance. 2 is 10% of 20. Therefore, you have a 0.98 chance of winning and a 0.02 chance of losing. That sounds great until you remember that if you lose, you lose $10 billion. And when you...
Can you re-explain that and start from the right instead of starting from the left?
I can do that. That's, in drawing the diagram, I have to start from the left to tell you what's the sequence of choices.
Right.
And then in solving it, I start from the right. So I was explaining first how I drew it, and that's a p equal 0.98 chance. On the right, you say, well, I don't get to choose whether I win or lose. That's just a random event, so I have to say, what's the average return? Two chances in 100 of losing $10 million is an expected loss of $200,000.
Okay, and that number came from the 20% times 10%?
That's right.
And 20% was what was the words representing 20%?
Sure, just a minute. Here we are. There is about a 20% chance. There is some risk. You think about 20% that somewhere in that email there is something that can be interpreted by a course as misrepresentation, raising their chance of prevailing to 10%. If they do prevail and so forth.
Okay, so 20% was...
I say without substantial evidence of misrepresentation, they have zero chance of prevailing.
Okay.
With that, they have a 10% chance of prevailing. There is a 20% chance that the evidence is there, so if you don't know if the evidence is there, the chance they'll prevail is 2%. If you do know the evidence is there, the chance that they'll prevail is up to 10%.
Okay, so if we know for sure it's 10%, that was given.
What?
There's a 20% chance that we won't know for sure.
No, there's a 20% chance that we... There's an 80% chance that we'll know for sure we're going to win,
okay,
because there's no evidence. There is a 20% chance that there is some evidence against us. If there is some evidence against us, there is then a 10% chance that we'll lose the case. 10% chance of 20% is 2%.
Okay.
So
that,
before
that,
we know...
relate that 20% chance of not... 20% chance that we have full evidence.
20% chance that there's evidence in the email against us.
A little bit of evidence.
Some evidence, right.
So... then there is a 10% chance that even that evidence won't win them the trial.
That it will win them the trial.
It will win. Okay, the opposite.
Yes. Raising their chance of prevailing to 10%. So if there is some evidence, there's a 10% chance that they'll win. There's only a 20% chance of the evidence being there. So there's a 10% chance of a 20% chance,
right,
that they will win.
Well,
that's 2%.
I found that it seemed like it was taken away from the same word.
I don't understand.
It was taken away from the same word. I felt like I found the 2%.
Yep.
I looked at it, I was like, you know what? It literally states there's a 10% chance. If there's evidence. So what we have to determine is whether or not there's going to be evidence.
Before we've done the search, if we do the search, then we know that. But I'm now following the branch where we haven't done the search. And if we don't do the search, then all we know is there's a 10% chance of a 20% chance. So then at that point, all we know is a 2% chance that we'll lose. If we do the search, we can do better than that, but I haven't gotten to that branch yet. All right? So if we don't do the search and go to trial, our cost is $200,000 plus $100,000 for the trial, which is $300,000. If we settle, it's 250. So if we haven't done the search, when we get to that box with the 250,000, we say, all right, we don't want to go to trial. That'll cost us 300,000. We'll settle. That's 250. So that means that if we don't search, our total cost for the case is going to be 250,000. We're just going to settle. All right. Now let's look at the other branch. We have the chance of three alternatives of searching. And if we search, we have to pay $50,000 for the search. And then there are two possibilities. There's a 0.2 chance that there's evidence, a 0.8 chance there isn't evidence.
Is that from the same number? Or is that
same numbers. I already said that there's a 20% chance there's evidence.
Okay.
0.2 is 20%, right? Same thing.
How come we're only doing it? Is there a reason why we chose the 80-20 breakdown? Because we're not worried about winning or losing it?
We haven't gotten there yet. We're trying. At the moment, I'm just asking. At the moment, I'm saying we've decided to search. We now have a die roll, in effect.
Right.
And we look at that die roll. And after the die roll happens, we then decide what to do, whether to go to trial or to settle. That's the point of searching, after all, is to know whether we should settle or not. There's a 0.2 chance that there is evidence. And if there is evidence, we have the choice of either settling for $250,000, going to trial for $100,000, but now we've got a 10% chance of losing, because this is the branch where we found out that the evidence is there. 10% chance of losing $10 million is $1 million. $1 million plus $100,000 is $1.1 million. That's a whole lot worse than $250,000. So if we find the evidence, we're going to settle. Is that clear? If we don't find the evidence, on the other hand, we know we'll win the trial. So if we don't find the evidence, the choice is between settling for $250,000 or going to trial for $100,000 and no chance of losing. $100,000 is better than $250,000. So therefore, if there isn't any evidence for going to trial, cost $100,000. If there is evidence for settling, cost $250,000. Is that?
No, that wasn't.
Still good. Puzzling, all right? What's the?
I think I just might not be able to see the words in here.
All right, well, it's a little bit fuzzy. Let me turn up the lights.
The numbers are fine. The numbers are fine. I just can't see those words.
Let me see if I can do it. Let me turn off a couple of lights to make it easier. All right. Let's look here. Search, don't search.
Okay.
On the search branch, either there's evidence or there's no evidence. That's not your choice. That's a die roll. That's why it's circular. 0.2 chance of evidence, 0.8 chance of no evidence. If there's no evidence, we know we'll win the trial.
Are we defendant or plaintiff?
We're the defendant.
Okay.
Throughout this, we're the defendant. We only start picking out from the plaintiff's standpoint in question two. Right? Question one, we're the defendant. And we say we do the search. If there is no evidence, then we know we'll win the case. Therefore, we go to trial, cost $100,000. We wouldn't settle for $250,000 when we know we're going to. If there is evidence, that's a 0.2 chance, 20% chance. Now things don't look so good for us. We say if we go to trial, well, we'll probably win, but there's a 10% chance of losing, and that's a $10 million judgment. So if we go to trial, we're going to have, on the average, $1 million in damages plus $100,000 in trial costs. Much better settle for $250,000. So we say if the die comes up this way, it's going to cost us $250,000. We're just going to settle. If the die comes up this way, we're going to go to trial. It's going to cost us $100,000. So therefore, the cost of being here...
Can we go back to that, the top square?
This. Right.
We're settling for $250,000.
Right.
I'm a defendant, and this is the money I'm about to pay off.
You're the defendant. That's right. The plaintiff has said, we'll settle the case for $250,000. And I, the defendant, I'm trying to... I say to my... I've done some research, and I say,
right,
look...
Hey, we can go to trial and make witness.
This is the case we've discovered there's evidence against you.
Okay, so now...
So if you go to trial, you will probably win, but there's a 10% chance of losing, and it's losing $10 million.
Right.
A 10% chance of losing $10 million is much worse than a $250,000
settlement. Okay, so I got confused because that $100,000, I guess that's the cost on top instead of...
This is the trial, this is the cost of the trial itself.
Okay.
Same as the cost of the trial down here.
Good.
Trial costs $100,000. However, there's $1 million. If we have the trial, there's then a die roll with $1 million expected cost. One chance in 10 is 10 million. All right? Is that?
No, it's all clear now.
All right. So that means, tracing this back, we say, well, if we get to this point, we have a 20% chance of paying $250,000. That's a $50,000 expected cost. We have a 80% chance of playing 100,000. That's an $80,000 expected cost, 0.8 times 100. 80 plus 50 is 130. So the result of, so once we've searched, we're now at a point where the expected return is 130,000. The search itself costs us 50,000. So therefore, searching plus the cost after searching is 180,000. That's better than the 250,000 down here, so we choose to search. All right, that's the logic of that one. And that was reasonably straightforward, I hope. The next one is now looking at it from the other side, from the plaintiff's side. And the plaintiff agrees about the numbers. He agrees that there's only a 20% chance that the evidence is out there, and if it's there, he's got a 10% chance of winning, all that stuff. And the question is, what should he demand? And he, as it happens, for some reason, has lower trial costs. So his costs are going to be $50,000 to trial. Subgame perfect equilibrium, we say, once, if he demands $250,000, then subgame perfect equilibrium says we've already solved that part of the problem. That was problem one. We know what happens. All right, so we know that if he demands $250,000, that the defendant will search. We've shown that's their best thing to do. When they search, there is an 80% chance that they will go to trial and we'll get nothing. In fact, we'll spend $50,000 on the trial, so it's worse than getting nothing. There's a 20% chance that they'll accept our settlement offer. Well, if they accept our settlement offer, we get $250,000. That's only one chance in five. It's only 20%. So we get $50,000 on average from a settlement. We lose $40,000 on average from their going to trial and winning, and it's costing us $50,000 to do so. That's a 0.8 chance of $50,000. That's a $40,000. So we make $50,000, we lose $40,000. On net, we're making $10,000. Because they're going to search, and they're only going to settle if the search turns up bad news. Does that make sense? All right. So that tells us one half of the answer. I'm trying to decide, should I ask for $250 or $100? So I say, if I ask for $250, I know what happens. On average, it will end up with $10,000. They'll search, they'll go to trial if they get good news, they'll settle if they get bad news, and that, on average, after I pay my trial costs, makes me $10,000. What if I ask $100,000? Well, that's really easy, because if you redo what we just did for a demand of $100,000, it's then easy to see that for a demand of $100,000, the cost following up this branch is again $50,000 for the search, and on this one is, let me scroll it up a little. If we go up the to the top to the search and the evidence, and there is evidence, that's going to cost another $50,000, and that's the good result if the search turns up. No, sorry, and if there's right, no, sorry, the settlement is now $100,000. Yes, so if they search, they pay $50,000 here, and they settle, so that's $50,000 plus 20% of $100 is another $20,000, that's $70,000. And if there isn't any evidence, they go to trial, and that costs them $100,000. So this branch is going to cost them more than $100,000 whatever they do. The lower branch is the one where they don't search, in which case, if they would have settled for $250,000, they'll certainly settle for $100,000. Same argument goes through. So therefore, if we demand $100,000, they won't search, they will settle, and we'll get $100,000 instead of $10,000. So I'm just applying the logic of saying, treat the final stage, the decision by the defendant, the way we just treated it as a decision theory problem, figure out what they're going to do, and then given that they're going to do that, what should I do? And the answer is I should ask for $100,000, not $250,000. There's probably some other number that's even better. I'm not saying $100,000 is the most I can.
Right, this is
but
based on what we're giving.
I was trying to make the problem simple by just giving you two choices. If you wanted to make it elaborate, you could say what's the most you could ask for, and that would be another interesting question, but I didn't ask that one. All right, so that's the first two. Any other questions on the first two questions? All right, question... Oh, any reasons why the assumptions might not hold? And many people saw that the defendant might be worried that if they settle, other potential plaintiffs will come out of the woodwork and demand settlement too, whereas if they win the case, they won't. Now, you could argue, I don't know if anybody did, but one might argue that the trial results are public record, whereas a settlement isn't. So maybe you could argue it the other way around and say they'll want to settle so that they can pretend they only settled for 10 cents, whereas if there's a trial and they lose, they're in real shit, bad shape. But either way, I just wanted people to see that the defendant would think about the consequence of what they did for future conflicts, and that might mess up the logic of the argument. Question 3 was
the assumption was what?
Sorry. You were supposed to think of any reasons why the assumption of subgame perfect equilibrium is that this game is the whole story, and all we have to do is to say at each point, what would you do? Whereas those assumptions don't hold if what you do in this game also affects future games.
And, okay, there was repetition.
Potential. Yeah. Right. All right. Question 3 was entirely trivial, provided you remembered what a strategy was, and undoable for those people who didn't remember, which was unfortunately a fair number of people. I made it only 5 points because it wasn't something I'd emphasized. On the other hand, I had gone through a couple of times what a strategy was and what a strategy matrix was, and I wanted to see if people, in fact, remembered it. Some did, but a fair number didn't. So here, what's going on is that the strategy is a description of what you'll do in any situation that within the game you get into. The parent only has one choice, put to bed, don't put to bed. If you look at the tree, that's all there is. The child has to say, if I am put to bed, what will I do? If I am not put to bed, what I will do? So the child has 4 alternatives. If I'm put to bed, throw a tantrum. If I'm not put to bed, throw a tantrum. That's one strategy. If I'm put to bed, throw a tantrum. If I'm not put to bed, be good and don't throw a tantrum. That's a second. If I'm put to bed, don't throw a tantrum. If I'm not put to bed, do throw a tantrum. That makes very little sense except to parents, who will realize that having a kid stay up too late may sometimes result in a tantrum with no good strategic reason. But it is one of the possible options, and we're trying to cover all the options. And then the fourth option is, don't throw a tantrum, whatever. I remember which ones I listed. You can see that the options are all never throw a tantrum, always throw a tantrum if put to bed and not if not, don't throw a tantrum if put to bed, but throw a tantrum if not. And that covers all 4 options. You can then look at the intersection of those, trace out the tree, and you'll see with each of those, if parent strategy is put to bed and child strategy is never throw a tantrum, well, that takes you to bed, it takes you to the not tantrum, and read the payoffs from that one, similarly for each of the others. So it's not a...
I can't see it at all. I don't know what...
You can't read it on the...
I can't see anything you're talking about.
You don't understand. Fine, let me try it again. Very good. A strategy is a full description of what the player will do in any situation. All right. So
I already understand all that.
You got that. Very good.
What I'm trying to figure out is where the child's strategy comes from.
Right.
Parent strategy is bed, not to bed. That's it.
And the child's strategy.
Child strategy is the same thing, except for dependent.
No, the child doesn't get to decide whether he's put to bed.
The child gets to decide where he throws that tantrum.
That's right. That's
so
right.
The child's decision is the same thing, except for it depends on the parent's choice.
That's right. So the child's decision could either be... The child then has 4 options.
Right.
Which are...
The child's option is based on an act of the parents.
The right? Child's option is what to do in response to each of the parent's moves. Right. Just as for a chess strategy, I would say, if he starts with pawn to king 4, I do such and such. Similarly, the child's strategy is, if my parent puts me to bed, throw a tantrum. And if he does not throw, because it's got to describe everything I'll do, if he does not put me to bed, throw a tantrum then too. For example, that would be one strategy.
That's one strategy.
Another strategy would be if the parent puts me to bed, throw a tantrum, but if he doesn't put me to bed, be a nice kid and don't throw a tantrum. That's a second strategy.
Right.
Third strategy is if my father puts me to bed, don't throw a tantrum. You know, I'm going to fold, I was bluffing. If my parents don't put me to bed, also don't throw a tantrum. Fourth strategy could be, I don't remember which order I have it here, it doesn't matter. But the fourth strategy could be if my parent throws me to bed, don't throw a tantrum, but if he doesn't throw me to bed, throw a tantrum. And that's not a very sensible strategy, but it's one of the options of what I could do.
Right.
Strategies aren't limited to good ones. And as I say, in fact, kids sometimes do act that way, even though they ought not to.
Oh, absolutely.
And so those are the 4 strategies. And then if you can you see this?
Lightweight.
Because this thing gets in the way a little bit, but... This one is showing the intersections. If parent strategy 1 is put to bed,
So if parent strategy one is put to bed, and if kid strategy one is never throw a tantrum whether or not put to bed, parent puts kid to bed, kid doesn't throw a tantrum, here you are, and those are the things. Run through the same thing for each of the other three, and for each of them we have pickups. Alright? For each of the other three of the children, and then you can say, well, the parent does don't put to bed. If the child's strategy is whatever happens, don't throw a tantrum, then we have don't put to bed, not tantrum, and those are the pickups. Alright? So
it's a way of expressing all of the possible alternative strategies and what happens for any parent. And do feel free to keep asking me to understand things, because the worst thing in teaching, essentially, is when people shut up because they're afraid that they'll look stupid or something, and then you don't actually learn stuff, and we're both wasting our time. So thank you.
Right. I mean,
Be stubborn. Right. Absolutely. So, the four, were there anybody have any questions on four? I sort of ran through a bunch of... What? Yeah, of different arguments. Five was a straightforward accounting one, and I was sort of unhappy with the fact that some people didn't get that right, and that was sort of the stuff that we've done in some detail. Lots of people did, but you know, that sort of felt like that was what everybody should have gotten. That was sort of a pretty much a giveaway. And I think that's it, unless people have questions. This shows that, but you've already seen it on the web. Any questions on any of this? If not, let's go back to the... Somewhere here is it's finance, there we go. And we were talking about basically time value of money kinds of issues. And those of you who've done this sort of stuff before, it's all pretty simple, but some of you may not have. And I did mention a useful trick if you ever want to sort of do quick arithmetic in your head, which is that a dollar a year forever is equal in value to 1 over the interest rate. That's its present value, because if the interest rate is 10%, if I have $10, I can put it in the bank and get a dollar a year forever, right? So that's sort of very simple, and that lets you do some problems without bothering to use Excel. The internal rate of return is the same calculation we were doing around the other direction, where you basically say you could make a certain investment now, it would give you a certain payoff over time. What interest rate is that equivalent to? So we say you want to build $1 million factory, it'll make you $200,000 a year for 8 years and then collapse. That's equivalent to investing your $1 million at what interest rate? You'd have to calculate what's the interest rate at which your $1 million would pay you $200,000 each year, interest plus some of the principal, and you'd run out of it at the end of 8 years. And that's useful, because if you say, I don't know what the number is, I'd have to calculate it, but if you say that's equivalent to an interest rate of 15%, you say, well, if we can borrow money at less than 15% and invest it in factories that pay us 15%, it's a good deal. If our cost of capital is more than 15%, on the other hand, we'd better not build that factory. All right, so that's a way of evaluating projects, is to say, what's the internal rate of return on that project? Is that clear to everybody? No questions? How do we redo our calculations once we allow for risk? Because after all, the interest rate that somebody offers you is what they say they're going to pay you, but firms have been known not to do what they say they will do. Firms sometimes go bankrupt, for example. So imagine that the court has awarded you $1 million settlement, and that will be payable over 5 years. And the possibility is trading that for a fixed payment now. And they certainly won't offer you $1 million now, because $1 million now is worth more than $1 million spread over 5 years. And the question you want to ask is, what's the lowest offer you should be willing to accept? If they offer you $900,000 now, should you accept it? If they offer you $800,000 now, should you accept it? And so forth. And the short answer is that depends on the interest rate, because if, for example, the interest rate was 10%, then it's easy to see that $900,000 plus 10% a year for 8 years, for 5 years, is going to end up with your having more than $1 million. All right. So, but then the question is, what's the right interest rate? And so imagine that the prime rate is 5%, that you can borrow at 10%, and the firm can borrow at 15%. And the first question is, why is there a difference between the prime rate and the rate the firm can borrow at? And do you care? Why is the rate the firm can borrow at even interesting? You're not the firm, after all. What does that 15% rate that they're paying tell you?
They're
a high-risk borrower, right? It says prime rate is 5%, and people who lend to them expect about a 10% premium to cover the risk of default. Why do you care about that?
Because it's greater than prime rate, first of all. Second of all, that's the amount that you have to return.
Because if they're going to default on their lenders, they also might default on you. Right? If they go bankrupt, they're not going to pay out that $1 million settlement. They're going to pay out as much of it as they pay before they go bankrupt. So you're going to want to use that interest rate as a source of information in saying, well, maybe I should accept not such a high offer now, because that'll actually give me the money, whereas, you know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, so to speak. All right? So you can do that calculation. So the first answer is that the difference probably reflects the risk of default, about a 10% chance of default each year, and you can use that to estimate the risk that you won't, and you should therefore say what they're really offering me is not $200,000 this year, $200,000 next year, etc. It's $200,000 this year, plus about a 90% chance of $200,000 next year, plus about an 81% chance of $200,000 the year after, and so forth, because it looks from the market as though it's believed they've got about a 10% chance each year of going bust or defaulting for some reason. So you can compare that those two streams, and that will let you decide. So in effect, you're discounting the payment at their interest rate, because that really represents an interest rate plus a risk of default, which is what you're concerned with. And that does assume that the risk they will default to their lenders is the same as the risk they'll default to you. And what you'll have to decide for yourself in any particular case, you know, whether that's right. If the reason they'll default is that the treasurer is going to run off with all the money to Panama, that's going to get you and the lenders. On the other hand, you might say the risk of default to me is higher. The lenders probably have better lawyers than I do. If they lend lots of money, they can put pressure on the company, and the company will say to me, well, we'll get you your money next month, or maybe the month after, or maybe the month after that, and then full. So you have to decide for yourself, but at least the risk premium they're paying gives you some useful information on what other people who have a good reason to know about it think the risk of default is. All right. You may also want to think about whether you're risk averse, obviously, because the bank probably isn't. So if you think more generally about choosing an interest rate for any of these calculations, where you're trying to decide about a mortgage, a loan, or anything, you're using an interest rate to compare costs and benefits across time. That's what we've been doing. And the easiest case, the one we usually sort of do, is we assume that there are no risks, and we assume that you can lend and borrow at the same interest rate. And in that case, it's easy. Use that interest rate to discount everything to the present and take whatever package costs less or pays most. Right. Next case, though, the one which most of us are in, is that the interest rate you pay if you borrow money is higher than the interest rate you get if you lend money. That's a common situation. And so you then say, well, all right, in this particular case, which am I going to be doing? So if you imagine, for example, that we're back at the case where you're trying to decide on a fixed payment versus a certain amount per year, you say, if I get that fixed payment, I am then, in fact, going to want to spread it out over time anyway, because I'm not going to use up all that money in the first year. So really what I'll be doing is getting my million or 500,000 or whatever, consuming a bit of it and putting the rest of it, lending the rest of it out in the bank or whatever my best loan is, so therefore the relevant interest rate is the interest rate I can lend at. On the other hand, if you imagine a case where what they're saying is we're going to either pay you $100,000 a year for 5 years, or we're going to pay you a very low wage, you know, $40,000 a year for the first 4 years, but there's a whopping big bonus at the end of it.
If you make it 3 or 4 years.
First, you'd have to figure out those probabilities. That's right. Maybe it's becoming partner or something. And after that, you would then say, well, all right, if I take that deal, if I take the deal with the low payment, I'm going to be borrowing money. right? In order to eat and have a house and such, I'll be borrowing against that future bonus, so then the relevant interest rate is the interest rate I can borrow at. So the real question you have to ask is, sort of on the margin as you're choosing these alternatives, are you going to be shifting money between present and future by lending, which is what you do if you're going to have lots of money now and need money later, or by borrowing if you're going to have lots of money later and need money now. And that would determine which of those interest rates is relevant. The next hard case, this is redundant, I don't need that too. Second hard case is not second hard case two, it's a second hard case. So, if there's risk, but you're risk neutral, now imagine you're risk neutral, but again, you're not sure you're going to make it through the 4 years, or that they are maybe, then you have to say, well, what do I think the probabilities are? And it's true they're offering $1 million in the fifth year, but there's only a 50% chance they'll actually get it, so that's really $500,000. Now discount that by the interest rate back to present and decide what it's worth. So that's pretty straight. And then the final case is if you're risk averse, and now you say, well, 50% chance of $1 million is not worth $500,000 to me. It's worth less than $500,000 to me. Figure out how much less it's worth. How risk averse are you or your client if you're deciding for someone else? So that's, I think, the logic of how you make these decisions. Questions? So notice, this is the point I made before, but make it again briefly at least, that the interest rate is not the same thing as the inflation rate, that you could have an economy with no money at all, a barter economy. Economics works fine in barter economies. It's just they're a damn nuisance. And there's still an interest rate because you're still be making deals in which I give you something now in exchange for something in the future. And if the things are the same things, if I'm giving you 100 apples this year and the deal is that you will pay me 106 apples in exchange next year, then the apple interest rate is 6%. All right? If the relative prices of all goods are staying the same, then with a little effort you can convince yourself that the apple interest rate, the orange interest rate, and the cookie interest rate are all 6%. Because if you wanted to trade oranges today for oranges a year from now, you could trade oranges today for apples a year from now, apples a year from now for oranges a year from now, and again you'd get 6% more. So that's just a sort of simple way of seeing that as long as relative prices stay the same, then even without money you've got an unambiguous interest rate. If relative prices are changing, though, it might be the interest rate in apples is different from the interest rate in oranges. Even with zero inflation, you still would expect a positive interest rate. Because as a general rule, if I have money today, I can easily convert it into money a year from now by just hiding it. But I can't do it the other way. So if I have money today, if a good option comes up, if a really good use for my money comes up in the next year, I can do it. If not, I can always spend it in a year. So on the whole, under most circumstances, we'd rather have money today than money in a year. And therefore, we would expect that as a general rule, there will be a positive interest rate. How can you get a negative interest rate? This is an issue which actually is beginning to become an interesting issue in the last 6 months or so. Imagine a world without inflation, so I don't want to worry about changes in prices. What's the situation in which you might end up with a negative interest rate? Yep.
The only thing I can think of is if more people want to lend. I mean, if people want to lend, but I don't.
But why would people want to lend at a negative interest rate? I think the answer is it has to be a world where there isn't a cheap way of doing the equivalent of putting your money under the mattress. It has to be a world where transferring money forward in time is costly. So if you imagine a world where most of the goods aren't durable goods and they'll rot if you try to store them, or a good where property rights are insecure and so you've got money all right, but during that year someone might break in and steal it, you might have a situation there where I have lots of money today, I'm going to need money in a year, and I'll pay somebody, in effect, to guard my money for a year. And the reason I'm saying that's relevant is that it was at least asserted...
Swiss Bank?
Well, Swiss banks, I think, pay positive interest rates. I was thinking of the U.S. government. It was being asserted for a while. I don't know if it's true, but during the credit crunch, it was asserted that the U.S. government was briefly able to borrow at zero interest rate. And presumably the reason they were doing it was that there were people in the world who did not think they had a really safe way of holding money for over time, and who believed, perhaps mistakenly, that lending the money to the U.S. government was a really safe investment? It probably is, but I'm less sure of that than I would have been 6 months ago, because we're in the process of doubling the national debt, which makes us more likely to default, and like any other debtor. So that what did look like it might be very briefly a case of people essentially willing, of zero, not quite negative, but very close, being willing in effect to pay the store their money. But so it's not logically impossible, but it's not a very common situation. All right. Now, it's still the fact that you didn't have safe ways of storing money doesn't guarantee a negative interest rate, because you could still go to somebody and say, I'll lend you the money. You say, fine, I'm going to plant apple trees and I'll be glad to pay you back a little bit more in a year. But if you imagine a case where there are lots of people who want to borrow where there are lots of people who want to lend, who want to shift money forward, few people who want to borrow, and you can't safely store wealth, that money isn't storable, or there aren't goods that are storable, gold is easily stolen or something, then you could have a negative interest rate. As I ran through before, the inflation rate tells you how many dollars you need next year to buy as many apples next year as $1 will buy this year. So the inflation rate is the rate at which apples are getting, or anything else is getting more expensive. And the nominal interest rate is the interest rate in money terms. That says, if I lend you $100, how many dollars will I get back next year? The real interest rate is the interest rate in real, that is in goods terms, and that says, if I lend you $100 today, and you pay me money back in a year, how much more will that money buy in a year than the $100 would buy today? So if the nominal interest rate was 10%, but the inflation rate was 10%, the real interest rate would be zero. Right, I lend you $100, which I could have bought 100 apples. You pay me back $110 in a year, which I can still buy 100 apples. So that's an important distinction to make, because when you have high inflation, and probably none of you remember the last time when the U.S. had serious inflation, but I do.
Which years?
It would have, let me think about that. I think the double-digit inflation would probably have been in the 70s. That sounds right. The U.S. has never, except during the Revolutionary War, I think, had real inflation in a global sense. That is to say, there have been countries where prices were going up at 50% a year or 50% a month. Germany, after World War I, is the famous example of hyperinflation, and people at least claimed that people were taking their money to the stores in wheelbarrows. It probably isn't true. They probably just put more zeros on the bills instead. But it is true that they had an inflation rate way above 100% a year. And Hungary had similar hyperinflation in the same period. I think hyperinflation is unlikely for the U.S., but I think one of the possible futures for the present situation would be one with higher rates of inflation than we've known. So you want to at least think about it. But one of the things to notice is that if inflation rates are large, the difference between real and nominal interest rates gets really important. So that if you really think that prices are going to double in the next year, and someone is willing to lend you money at only 20%, that's a great deal. They lend you money at 20%, you buy some nice, easily marketable goods, and in a year you sell them for twice as much, pay them as 20%, and you got the rest. And similarly, if you're buying a house and arranging for a mortgage, it matters a whole lot whether you believe prices are going up. Now, of course, your beliefs might be wrong. Obviously, lots of people did buy houses believing not that the inflation rate was going to continue, but the rise in house prices are going to continue, and turned out to be wrong. So, as a general historical rule, the usual pattern is real interest rates over the long term of somewhere vaguely around 2%. Don't know if that will still be true in the future, but it has been in the past. And note that nominal interest rates of 10%, inflation rate of 20%, in effect, when you borrow money, the guy who's lending it to you is paying you to take it on net, if you think in real terms rather than nominal. Is that point clear? Fairly important point if we get real inflation. Risks, or that was inflation, but risk is the other element we've just been discussing and sort of assuming, but I may as well go through it explicitly. If for a risk-neutral lender, I lend you $100, you pay back $160 in a year, interest rate is 6%, but what if I believe there's a 50% chance you won't pay, you're going to go bankrupt? How much do you have to give me back if you pay so that I'm getting 6%? If you have a 50% chance of going bankrupt, I lend you $100, how much do you have to promise me in a year so that on average I'm getting 6%? Heads, I get nothing. Tails, I get what?
Something.
How much? I got this great deal for you, right? You give me a dollar, flip a coin. Heads, like you get nothing. Tails, you get 10 cents. Is that a good deal? No, you get something, but not very much. 212, right. If I'm going to have to say, if you 50% chance, you get 212, so on average, you're getting 106. All right? So that demonstrates the way in which risk premiums are going to work. When should you be risk neutral? Remember that what matters to you is not the risk of this particular loan, but the effect on your income. So if you are making 100 independent risky loans, that's in fact not very risky, assuming they're of similar size, because the law of large numbers says if each of them has a risk of 20%, then just about 80 of them are going to pay off and about 20 of them aren't going to, so that's pretty safe. You're going to get money back on 80 of them, and then you have to see how much money that is. But that's for a risk neutral. So you can be risk neutral there. Whereas you're making one loan with a 20% chance of not being paid back, and that loan is a large part of your wealth, now you don't just say, well, on average, I'm getting such and such an amount. You say, wait a minute, there's a 20% chance I'm going to be out on the street with, you know, begging with a tin cup in my hand. That I'm not willing to accept unless I get an awful big premium. All
small
right.
Casinos have table stakes.
What?
So small casinos have table stakes.
Ah, do they? Yes. So... so that suggests that a bank should be very nearly risk neutral, and a stockholder who has a diverse portfolio should be very nearly risk neutral, except what's the kind of a risk you should not be risk neutral against, even if you have a portfolio of many stocks? Suppose your portfolio was of many buildings in a town, and we say, well, look, we're renting these buildings out, and you know, once in a while somebody breaks into a building and trashes it and we lose money. Once in a while the tenant doesn't pay and we lose money. That's going to average out. What's the risk that's not going to average out?
Hurricane.
Risk of a hurricane, right. The hurricane is either all your buildings or none of them. Or a big fire. Or a war. You can think of other things like that. Right. So it's important, if you're thinking about whether you're risk neutral, to distinguish between those risks which don't correlate with each other and which average out, and those risks which do correlate. Right? I like to claim that the one great advantage of being an economist is you can answer the question of, you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Because one of the things economics tells us is that there isn't an easy way of using economics to get rich, which is sort of interesting. And think about, I don't know if any of you listen on the radio to these people who are telling you what the stock market's doing today, but they all talk as if they knew why. And they're lying. So one way of saying is, look, the stock's going up. You should buy it, right? Buy it when it's going up. Other people say, no, the stock just went up. We should sell it. It's obviously above its long-term value. Sell it, because it's going to go down again. And, of course, if either method worked, it wouldn't work. Because if it were really true that the fact that the stock had gone up 5% yesterday meant it's going to go up 5% tomorrow, then nobody would sell it to you today at today's price, because they want to hold it for 5% tomorrow. And the other way, if everybody knew that if it went up 5% today, it would go back down 5% tomorrow, nobody would pay that 5% higher price today, because they know they're going to lose the money tomorrow. There are a bunch of more elaborate strategies along these lines, which is referred to chartism or chartists. And if you listen to the radio accounts, when they say there was a lot of profit taking in this session, all that means is it went up yesterday and went down today. Because after all, the total number of shares being held is still the same when it goes up and down. So when it went down, some people who made money sold their shares, but other people bought those shares. And there's a bunch of other stuff, which at least in my opinion should be more or less ignored. And one way of seeing why mostly that's not very useful stuff is, imagine that you knew that investors are superstitious and that on Thursday the 12th they will sell their stock because they believe that Friday the 13th something bad is going to happen. So the result is that the stock always drops on or just before Friday the 13th. What ought you to do as a non-superstitious person?
Buy it.
Buy it when it drops, right? Wait till noon of the 13th or something. Make sure no black cats have crossed your path. And buy that stock because you say, day is over, catastrophe won't have happened, stocks would go back up. The only reason it dropped was this irrational thing, believe people had. If a significant number of people make this argument, what is in fact going to happen when stocks begin to drop sort of at the end of the session on Thursday? As soon as they drop 1%, what's going to happen?
It's going to change that. 1% is going to change the region regardless.
But all I'm saying is that if people know the reason that dropping is superstition, then they will see that drop as an opportunity to buy, and the drop won't happen, or very little of it will happen. Right? So it's basically the same logic. And in fact, this is what's referred to as the efficient market hypothesis in its weak form. And it applies to lots of other cases. So that one of the experiences that probably all of you have had is you're driving along on the freeway and it's pretty crowded, as it sometimes is around here. And you say, well, look, the next lane over is going faster. So you switch to the next lane over. And just as you switch, you notice that right behind you is this really battered old blue pickup. And 15 minutes later, the battered old blue pickup still in the lane you left is just about parallel to you. And you say, well, isn't that odd? It's the perverse nature of the world. As soon as I switch into a lane, it slows down. But of course, what's happening is that the fact the lane is going faster is a reason for not just you, but other people to switch into it, which makes it slow down. And therefore, your right rule of thumb is that there are special cases. You may say, well, this lane is slow because it's an exit lane or because there's construction. But as a sort of general rule of thumb, you should assume that among the lanes that people are free to choose among, they'll all be about the same speed, because anytime one of them is faster, people switch into it, which slows it down. And that's really the same kind of logic. And the example I used a long time ago in an economics textbook is supermarket lanes. That you, and the way I normally, see if I have the story here. Here we are, yes. Let's go back for a moment. Which is, you're there, there's the bunch of lines in the supermarket, you've got your arms full of groceries, you foolishly didn't get a cart, and the question is, do you go along all of the lanes looking for the shortest one, or do you go into the first one? And the answer is you go into the first one. And the simple version of that is that the reason you go into the first one is because other people are checking, at least when they come in between two lines, they'll always go to the shorter one. And that's going to tend to make the lines all about the same length. So all of these are really the same argument to any situation with this logic. So let's take the economic version, the formal version of my Friday the 13th story. And the weak form of the hypothesis is that you can't make money using past information about stock prices to predict future prices. And the basic argument is that as soon as any such information becomes available, the prices reflect the information, so now you've got the information, but if the information shows that stock's going to go high, it's already high, or it shows it's going to go low, it's already low. For example, the things that I've described. Putting it differently, if it is below its long-run level, rather than saying that's just random, it's going to go up, you say, well, there's some reason why it's below, there's some reason people aren't taking this opportunity, so therefore there's no particular reason to assume it'll go back up. The semi-strong form of the hypothesis is that you can't use money by using other publicly available information either, so that not only can you not make money by using the fact that the price has gone up or down, you know that the demand for heating oil goes up in the winter. And I have heard radio advertising that you're saying, look, go to us and buy oil futures, heating oil futures, because after all, it'll be cold in the winter, and so the price of heating oil will go up. But of course, the obvious question is, who is selling you those heating oil futures? Doesn't he know that prices go up in the winter too? And therefore, you would expect that the heating oil futures, which are the price for heating oil to be delivered, say, in January, already reflect that public information. And similarly for any other publicly available information. And then the really strong version of it is that all information is incorporated in the stock price. And then you've got to think a little bit about what information means, because we can say, well, look, as it happens, there's a meteor out there. I don't know if you saw, by the way, there was actually a close miss to Earth sometime in the last few weeks. The, people know about the Tunguska event?
Yeah.
1908, I think, multi-megaton airstrike in Siberia.
That was...
What? Tunguska.
Tunguska.
It probably was a meteor or part of a comet, we're not quite sure what, but some kind of a thing came out of the sky and flattened a very large, like the area the size of Rhode Island or so in Siberia. And eventually scientists got there and measured it. And apparently a fair-sized meteor made a miss by, I don't know what it was, 50,000 miles or something of the Earth quite recently. And the interesting thing is they haven't seen it, that there are people who are trying to map all of the near-Earth asteroids. Because once you've watched one for a while, Newtonian physics is really good. And so there are, for example, calculations of asteroids that will miss us by not very far 400 years from now, because you just plot out the orbit. And if you know it's going to miss us 60 years, if you know it's going to hit us 60 years from now, you might be able to do something about it. You might be able to nudge it just a little, and over 60 years that turns a hit to a near miss. Anyway, there are projects of that sort. But there was one, not a very big one. It probably, you know, would have taken out San Jose if it hit us, but a random hit is unlikely to hit San Jose, fortunately, unless maybe it's being piloted by Microsoft. They're aiming for Cupertino. But in any case, a really big one, though, could just sort of unmake your century, so to speak. And that's one of the conjectures about the dinosaurs, as you probably know. Not just the dinosaurs, a whole bunch of species went extinct at about the same time. And I think one, if I've got it right, that's also when we got the Gulf of Mexico. I think, though I'm not sure, that the theory has the Gulf of Mexico as being the periphery of that crater, but I'm not sure I've got that one right. Man, they have misread it. Anyway, so you can't expect the stock prices to anticipate the fact that there's a meteor that's going to hit your factory a month from now. So don't think of that as information. If you think of all the information that anybody's got at this time, then the strong version would be that's all incorporated. And then the question is, can that be entirely true? Could it be a complete description of market prices that the market price at any instant fully incorporates all information? Yes or no?
Absolutely.
No, can't be true. I'm going to claim it can't be true. And my claim is that the mechanism by which it's become, the mechanism which makes it approximately true is that people gather information, they look at what's known, and they say, all right, best estimate I can make is there's going to be a bad harvest next year, let's bid up the price of wheat a bit. But if the market was perfectly efficient, you could never make any money by gathering information. If you can never make any money by gathering information, there's no incentive to gather the information. And if there's no incentive to gather the information, there's no mechanism to keep the market efficient. So if you think about the grocery store checkout lane, if everybody says to himself, I know, I mean, I've taken this economics course, and I know that all the lanes are the same line, so don't bother to look, just go to the nearest lane. In that world, the lanes wouldn't be the same length, right?
I told you I can't.
You don't see that.
It's a waste of time right now.
All right.
Sorry.
You don't see the logic of that?
I haven't followed you since you said efficient market hypothesis.
All right. Other people having problems also or not? No. The efficient market hypothesis in various forms says that the current prices of stocks incorporate information that might be used in deciding what the future prices would be.
And incorporate transaction costs?
Depending on the form of it, the claim would be that the current price reflects the best possible estimate of the future value of the stock.
Right.
And that can't be fully true because it was completely true, because the mechanism that tends to make the present price reflect best estimate of future things is people making estimates of future things and then buying or selling accordingly. But they only do that if, on average, they can make money by doing that. And they can only... That doesn't make... Suppose it were true... Think about...
You're just talking about people making decisions based on the market. Does it follow an Adam Smith or a Keynesian? Or is, I mean, where are we going with this?
As far as I know, neither Adam Smith nor...
Problems in the future.
Neither Adam Smith nor John Maynard Keynes, as far as I know, discussed the efficient market hypothesis.
Okay.
I don't know if either of them saw the logic of it. But the argument is you have a stock market or a futures market for grain or some market like that, and there are prices in that market. And the question is, are there ways of predicting change, future changes in prices by which you can make money? And many people believe there are. And to take a very, very simple version of that, people would say, well, look, there is a future market for heating oil. I know that the demand for heating oil goes up in the winter. Therefore, the price of heating oil should be higher in the winter. Since I know that, I should buy now the right to have to delivery of heating oil this winter, and I'll make money. And that's wrong. Because when you buy it, the price you will pay is not the price for heating oil at the moment. It's the seller's estimate of what heating oil will be worth in the winter. He knows that winters are cold too, so the price you're buying the oil for already incorporates the information that both of you have about what's going to happen in the winter. And then the different forms of the efficient market hypothesis are stronger and stronger assumptions about how much such information is being incorporated. So the weakest form says everybody can look and say what the price of the stock was last year, the year before that. So if there were really predictable trends, it was really the case that if a stock had been rising for a few years, that meant it would keep rising, then at this point its price wouldn't be here. Because people would say, no, it's going to be up here in a year, so bid it up to there now. Why should anybody who has the stock sell it at this price if we can predict it's going to be here in a year? All right? So that would be the weak form, which says that that kind of information is already incorporated. And therefore, you can't make money speculating on stocks if all you have is information about their past prices. And the guy who sells it to you in a sense, speculation is always a bet. And when the guy who sells it to you knows the same thing you do, he's not going to make bets that you win and he loses. And the somewhat stronger version says that not only is information about the past stock prices incorporated, all other publicly available information, such as what the weather is like or what we know about global warming or whatever, is also incorporated. And then the strongest version says all information. Even if it's private, as long as more than a couple of people know the information, they'll have an incentive to act on that information, and that'll bid the price of the stock to what it ought to be, and that would be the strongest form. And what I was arguing was that the strong form version can't be entirely true, because, you can think of this as transaction cost if you like, because it costs something to gain information, even publicly available information. You've got to do research, search through the databases and so forth. And people will only bear the cost of getting the information in order to buy stock or oil or whatever it is if they think they get some gain from doing so. And they'll only get some gain from doing so if the existing price doesn't fully represent what the price would be if you had all the information. All right? And that's why an efficient market hypothesis can be an approximate but not an exact description. And I was then taking the supermarket line example, where saying if you imagine a bunch of lanes in the supermarket, there is some tendency for them to be all the same length, because if you come in between two lines, you go to the shorter, which makes it longer. All right, does that make sense so far?
Right.
But it can't be perfectly true, because there is also, after all, some time and effort to you in seeing which is shorter, especially because what you really care about is not how many people are in the line, but how long it's going to take them to go through. And the lady who's got a cart stacked this high is going to take a lot longer than the guy with one bottle of soda. So therefore, you would have to engage in some effort looking at what's there to decide which is the shortest line. You'll only engage in that effort if, on average, the lines aren't exactly the same, and therefore you can get some payoff to spotting the shorter one, and therefore you would expect that the lines would be about equal, but just unequal enough to make it worth some people's efforts to spot the shorter ones and go to them. All right? That's the basic argument. And that's why I'm claiming that the perfectly efficient market can't be right. So, in fact, I want to claim there are two limits to the efficient markets. One is the one I've just made, that if it were perfectly true, nobody would gather the information needed to make it true, to make the right bets. And but if you think about that different people have different costs of search. So I started my story where you had an armful of groceries. Your cost of going checking out all the lanes is much higher than the guy who's got one bottle of soda, or even the lady with the cart, because at least she's got a cart. So therefore, you should go to the shortest line. You're not a low-cost searcher. And you should say, yes, the lines will be a little uneven, but not enough uneven enough to make it worth my checking, not uneven enough to make him check, and his checking will keep him from getting more uneven than that. All right, that's the basic logic of it. And similarly, if you're thinking about the stock market, if you have spent your life in the oil industry and you have expert opinions on how well managed companies are and where oil is going to be found and you know who's drilling where and so forth, it might make sense for you to try to say, sell Shell, you know, buy Mobil, because Shell is making bad bets and Mobil is making good bets. If you are you or me, what do we know about the oil industry? What we read in the newspaper, we should say, no, might as well throw darts at the Wall Street Journal. Shell, Mobil, they're equally good gambles for me in terms of my information. But, of course, you might know something else. All right, there might be some other area where you really are an expert. I've got some checkout line examples, but I'll skip over those for the moment. And the limits, the fact that it isn't perfectly efficient, explain things like hedge funds, because what the hedge fund is doing is making very large market transactions with very small profits per dollar. And you can, if you're doing it on a large enough scale, you can go to Harvey Mudd or Caltech and hire the very best people at doing hard math fast, basically. And pay those people lots of money, and they will tell you, well, it isn't obvious, but I've analyzed it, and on average you can make 0.5% profit if you make this transaction in the next hour. Well, $100 million, 0.5% profit, that's a lot of money. And in fact, are any of you blackjack players?
That's the best game to play when you go to the casino.
If you're good.
I'm thinking completely in terms of logic, like no skill.
Oh, there is skill in blackjack.
Black numbers and love.
Blackjack. Not, you're talking about roulette, I think.
Play a house game, then yes.
Oh, okay.
But
you say not at the actual casino.
There's a man whose name I've now forgot who wrote a book called Beat the Dealer, who was the first person who solved blackjack. He essentially was able to prove that there was a strategy you could follow, at least as blackjack was then played, where on average you made money. And the strategy involved the fact, you know, blackjack is 21. It's a card game where basically as the game is played, you've got a deck, you're seeing cards being played out. So after half the deck is played, that's no longer a random deck. You now know that, you know, three of the four jacks have been played, so there's only one jack left in the deck and so forth. So you can now recalculate the probabilities in terms of you've actually seen played. And it turns out if you do that and you're good enough at it, and you then make only small bets most of the time. And once in a while, when the deck is far enough from its random arrangement so that you know that certain bets that normally don't make money, you make big bets then. Thorpe, that was his name, somebody Thorpe. And so he wrote that book, and the result is that a very good blackjack player can make money, and the casinos try to spot those players and throw them out, because they lose money, of course, if they do it. I gather that after he wrote the book, Thorpe went into the business of doing the equivalent of what hedge funds do, of essentially using similar mathematical analysis to figure out transactions that made, on average, small profits. Big profits are better, but those are harder to find. And another problem in the meaning of efficient markets is, what do you count as information being out there? Because Warren Buffett has said that he proves the efficient market theory is wrong. Because Warren Buffett, over a very long period of time, kept making gambles and winning. And the efficient market theory says, you know, throw darts at the Wall Street Journal, you do as well as anybody else. And Buffett says, well, you know, you could say I was just lucky, but you can do some mathematics. And it turns out that nobody should have been that lucky, that basically what he was doing was the equivalent of flipping a coin and getting, say, 1,000 heads. You can work out pretty easily that the chance of that happening is about 1 over 1 with 30 zeros after it, which isn't going to happen. All right. But one answer to that is it wasn't luck. It's that Warren Buffett is very, very good at evaluating certain kinds of information. So what's information to him isn't information to me. All right? And in that sense, the efficient market hypothesis is sort of blurring over that kind of distinction.
But you can always observe Buffett to understand, but you don't have to.
Well, he buys first. Warren Buffett is an investor who had a company called, still has, I think, called Berkshire Hathaway. And it was a company which basically owned other companies. And people who invested with Berkshire Hathaway near its beginning are essentially now all millionaires. Because it went up like, you know, 10,000 times, that kind of number, over a period of 30 years or something. But in fact, I would claim that I've done the same thing. And in fact, let me tell you, for those of you who are computer, I'll tell you the story of the guess of mine that I'm proudest of. This was a long, long time ago, in the ancient years, when the IBM PC ran an operating system called MS-DOS. Macintosh ran a graphic operating system. All right? And there was a very interesting phenomenon I observed, and that was that the leading spreadsheet and the leading word processor on the Macintosh were made by Microsoft. And I said, this doesn't seem to make any sense. That Microsoft has an advantage for software on MS-DOS because they wrote the operating system. But on the Macintosh, they're competing, among other things, with Apple, and they wrote the operating system. Why is Microsoft investing a lot of money in a small market? There are a lot more MS-DOS machines than Mac machines out there, at which they have no big advantage. And I said to myself, I think I know why. The reason why, I have used a Macintosh, and I've used other computers before the Macintosh. It wasn't my first computer. And I can see that the graphic interface the Macintosh uses is the wave of the future. That it's just a much easier and more intuitive way of using computers than the command line interface, which is what we used to use. I bet Bill Gates can see that too. He's a smart guy.
Oh, absolutely.
I can see, this is before Windows, remember. I can see that the reason that the Mac has a graphic interface and the PCs don't is that the Mac has got a central processing unit which was originally made for multi-user machines. That the Mac, in effect, was like a sedan with a race car motor in it. And this was not widely, you know, I was a geek then too, so this was not widely appreciated. 68,000, Motorola 68,000. And then I can remember at the point when I got my Mac, where I told a colleague I was getting one, he said, why don't you get a PC Junior instead, which was the sort of cheap, small PC. Well, if you look at the physical size, they're about the same size, but the answer is the PC Junior was running a processor that was like a 20th as fast as the Mac processor. Why does the Mac have this way too powerful processor? Because graphic interfaces are resource hogs. That the computer, instead of just saying, you tell it to do something, do it, the computer's got to be watching, in effect, that whole screen. Did a mouse click here? Did a mouse click here? What do I do then? It's a much harder way of running a computer. So the Mac could support a graphic interface, and the PC couldn't support a graphic interface. This is why, when the first version of Windows came out, the comment that many people made was, it doesn't run, it crawls. All right. I can see that. Gates can see that. I also know that computer chips are getting faster and faster, including the chips that are currently running the PCs. So that means at some point in the next few years, the machines now running MS-DOS are going to be fast, the equivalent of those, the heirs of those, are going to be fast enough to run a graphic interface. When that happens, Microsoft is going to be sitting there with a word processor, which they have spent 3 years getting, perfecting on the Macintosh. And they're going to port it over to the big market. They're going to be sitting there with a spreadsheet, which they have spent 3 years polishing and perfecting and trying out on the Macintosh, and they're going to port it over to, I didn't know it was going to be Windows, but to whatever the graphic interface is going to be on the PCs, and they will suddenly be in the dominant position on the big market. I bought Microsoft stock. That was a very long time ago when Microsoft stock was not very expensive. And sure enough, in another few years, suddenly WordStar is replaced by Microsoft Word on the PCs, and suddenly Lotus 1-2-3 is replaced by Excel on the PCs. Those were the two programs that I'd been watching on the Macintosh. So that was a case where I said to myself, I'm an insider. I'm not legally an insider. But most people in this industry are not computer enthusiasts. They didn't have their own computer when nobody else did. They aren't watching this stuff. They can't evaluate these facts. They don't know what a graphic interface is. I knew about graphic interfaces before there was a Macintosh. I saw a film about the Xerox Star, which was the machine that Apple stole the idea from, basically. And so I bet on that, and I made lots of money on that bet. And I've lost money on some bets, too. I'm not claiming that I always bet right. My point is only that whether that's a violation of efficient markets depends on whether you think of each particular investor's specialized expertise as information publicly out there, or whether you say, no, each of us has particular narrow expertise. In that narrow area, you can bet against the market, basically, because you know more than the market does. All right? And part of the logic of that is interesting. Is before buying Microsoft stock, I did not look at Microsoft's financials. I did not look at their accounting data, even if I could have read it, which I couldn't have then because I hadn't studied any accounting. What I said was rather, the current market price of Microsoft stock reflects what it would be worth to somebody who didn't know what I know. Other people have already looked at how much money they're making and how much their debt is and what their assets are, and they've priced the stock. They don't know, if I'm right, what I'm gambling on, that Bill Gates has made this very clever decision, which is going to mean that in a few years he's going to own the word processor and spreadsheet world. So, if the stock is worth $50 without that information, it's got to be worth $100 with it, I should buy it at $50. And that was the gamble I made. I made the same gamble with Apple. Now, I also made that gamble with BE, for those people who know it, which is an attempt at starting a new operating system, which failed. BE was the name of the company. It was a company that was starting. BEOS was the name of their operating system, and they had a rather neat attempt to compete with both Mac and PC. And at the point when I bought the stock, I thought I'd lose money, but there was a small chance I'd make a whole lot of money, and it was worth taking that gamble. The odds were better than even; they would fail. And I've made one other investment of that sort, But in each case, it seems to me that one way, the sort of standard way of trying to make money on the stock market is to study everything you can about the firm and say, aha, this firm is a little better than the others, it's going to go up. That's really hard. And the other way is to say there is something important I know about this firm, which other people don't know, which is either positive or negative, bet on that and let other people do the rest of the calculation. So that's my word of advice on how to make money, but if you lose money, don't blame me. And the third way to profit on the stock market is not to make money, it's to hedge risk. So that my wife is in fact an oil geologist, though this isn't what she's done for a long time. But back when she was working for Shell, I didn't buy oil stocks. Because if the oil market goes up, my wife's salary will go up, and my oil stocks will go up. If the oil market slumps, and it's a market that does a lot of up and down, my wife might be unemployed and we'll lose the money on our stocks. So if, in order to hedge your bets, if other features of your life mean that you're automatically betting on something like the oil market, then you ought to try to bet against that market where you're free to choose your bets in terms of what stocks you own. All right, so that doesn't make you any richer, but it makes you better off because it lowers the risk. It lowers the uncertainty of your income. Let's go back to your hurricane. Yes?
Oh, I have a quick question. So your special expertise knowledge that you're talking about, is that like an exception to the efficient market?
That's one way of putting it, but another way of putting it is that it's a way in which the efficient market is oversimplifying the world because there's a model in which the same information is available to everybody. And in one sense, it's true. Anybody who wanted could have found out that Microsoft had the dominant word processor on the Mac. But evaluating that information is a much more complicated issue because reasonable people can differ. And all I was saying was that I had an evaluation on something I thought I knew a lot about, which I was willing to gamble on. And, you know, I could be wrong, obviously. But it was clearly the case that I knew much more about this than most of the people I knew. And so that gave me some reason to think I had some expertise. I mean, there weren't a whole lot of professors in whatever that was, 1990 or 1980 or something, who had programmed computers. So we make the point that you diversify your portfolio, and that therefore the kind of risky investments that will have to pay a higher return to compensate for the risk are the ones that correlate with other risky investments. That's your hurricane. So if the reason this company might go up or down is because their particular industry might go up or down, fine, I'll buy some stock in that industry, some in that. But if the reason they might go up or down is the economy might go up or down, now I can't diversify away that by buying a bunch of, unless I could find some company which goes up when the economy goes down. All right. So let me give you this problem to think about since we're running out of time. Suppose that I have a firm which anti-correlates. My firm provides services to the state unemployment bureaus. So when the economy is in a slump, unemployment is up, there's a big demand for my services, I hire more people and make out like a bandit. On the other hand, when things recover, it's not so good. Better shut down for a while. Suppose that ordinary risk-free investments, if there are any, pay 8%, and that ordinary stocks pay 10% in order to compensate for market risk. What will I have to offer to get investors to buy my stock? I don't want a number. I want a range. Anyway, I will let you think about that question, and you can come back with the answer Tuesday. Oof.